Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The COVID-19 vaccine has been touted as the light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic, but the rollout has been slow, including here in Wyoming. And some think that's because there have been no federal guidelines.
If we had had a national plan, we would have a very easy footprint to follow, but we don't.
As Wyoming was distributing CARES Act funding, the issue of rental assistance was not properly addressed.
There is an unknown and unmeasured need.
And the federal government unexpectedly signed off on unprecedented support for carbon capture technology. Wyoming hopes it will save coal.
We will do anything we can to encourage and incentivize companies and corporations to invest in within Wyoming.
Plus, our Washington reporter tells us what it was like to be in the Capitol during the siege. It's coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. We will begin the program by hearing from our Capitol Hill correspondent, Matt Laszlo, who was in the Capitol when it was stormed by Trump supporters this week. He says he was covering the Senate.
I was posted up right outside of the Senate chamber. You always see the security detail around the vice president, but the security detail, especially the Secret Service, they're usually, you know, calm, not flustered at all. But I saw four or five Secret Service agents whispering to each other right outside of the chamber. And then three or four other Secret Service members were going by the windows, looking out right over where President-elect Biden will get inaugurated. And so as a curious reporter, I follow the police. And if their eyes are over there, my eyes are over there. And that's where I first felt the reverberations of the blast grenades, but I had no idea what was going on, but I could see police officers not freaking out, because at first I thought it was a gunshot, but more than a gunshot, because you could actually feel it in the Capitol, and there's these puffs of smoke, and then all these Capitol police officers, they just kept coming with crates and crates and crates of bottles of water. And it was because of all the tear gas, which was way lower than I could have seen. But I saw about five or six Capitol police officers brought up, some just reeling in pain. It was really painful to watch. And then slowly they retreated and mayhem ensued.
So where were you when people started entering the building?
I was still there. So I was on the second floor of the Capitol, and I'll plug myself as a freelancer. I did a bunch of tweeting on it at my handle, at Matt Laszlo, but I was perched right above, so kind of right across from Mitch McConnell's office on the second floor, but right underneath it is the first floor, and that's right where they were breaching. So I was recording video, and you see all these people there, and I, like everyone else, thought the U.S. Capitol, like the White House, is one of the most secure buildings on the planet. But then at a certain point, I couldn't even see the windows break. I later saw the footage on Fox News. But you just heard these cheers and all these people from the back rushed. And there was no space for them. So it was like, oh, no, they're inside the building. And I'm laughing now. But then I wasn't laughing, and that's when officers said, go, and they kicked us out of the second floor. They took every senator who was walking around the chamber, ushered them in real quick, locked the doors. Me and a bunch of other reporters huddled in their radio TV gallery, which is on the fourth floor of the Capitol, for a couple hours, and once we heard tear gas and stuff was being deployed in the rotunda, we went down, me and a Colorado Public Radio reporter went down to grab gas masks, which is on the third floor. And when I got out there, there weren't the police officers who were usually standing there. Instead, there were people with don't tread on me flags, MAGA hats, and they didn't look like they loved the press corps. So we just beelined it back upstairs, locked the doors, covered up insignias, just as Radio TV Correspondence Gallery. We've been called the enemy for more than 4 years now. So I did not want to alert anyone that there was a bunch of reporters in there. Luckily, no one got up. We're kind of tucked in a hard to find place, but it was hard. Fox Radio News reporter, who's a good buddy of mine, he had a panic attack. It was scary.
Could you hear things?
Oh, we could hear chants of USA, USA from within the building. We would kind of go out a little bit to peek. And again, knowing that the Capitol Police had completely abandoned the third floor of the Capitol, we kind of just all decided together to not really show ourselves. So I didn't see the rotunda and that stuff get breached. Eventually, some officers came. And then they escorted us. And the windows were broken, and they were spraying pepper spray out of them. So the whole entire hallway was filled with pepper spray. And because we couldn't get the gas masks earlier, that didn't feel good. So we kind of ran through. So they booted us to some cafeteria where we huddled for 3 or 4 hours. It was a long day.
Matt Laszlo visiting with us. Matt, I want to ask you, one of the things that seemed interesting to me is it seemed like there were people in Congress who didn't want to overturn the vote totals, but we're going to have an open mind and let other people talk. Did that attitude change when they came back later in the day?
Yeah, everyone was, I almost want to say deflated, but you really felt the mood change in the Republican Party. And even this morning, I was watching Fox and Friends, and was watching Fox all day, actually. And you're starting to see a real change in how Republicans and conservatives are talking about President Trump. So we're wondering here in this rumorville of Washington, how much of this is some of them trying to save face now that Trump's going out of office. Or I think with a lot of them, it was really unsettling to be in the Capitol. Like, it was terrifying, really kind of focused a lot of people.
Well, Matt, we're happy you're safe. Thank you for taking time with us, and let's hopefully we can get you back reporting here in the not-too-distant future. Matt Laszlo, our reporter in Washington, and who certainly had an interesting day this week as the Capitol was stormed. Thank you.
Thank you.
The rural West voted overwhelmingly for President Trump last election, but after this week's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, our Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie wanted to find out how people were feeling about the president and the state of our country now.
Last summer, I met with Ben Bardo outside the small town of Dubois, Wyoming. He's a huge Trump supporter, and we were having a conversation about where he thought America was headed.
Revolution?
You think so?
I do. I think it's headed there.
Flash forward to the violent scenes at the U.S. Capitol. I checked in with Bardo again to get his take. And he says we're inching even closer to revolution.
It just hasn't started yet.
And the violence at the Capitol? He believes the loose anti-fascist movement Antifa was there, causing trouble.
It was orchestrated. You know, they will do anything to cause chaos and disrupt. And they had to figure out a way to turn the whole world against Trump supporters.
Let's be clear. There is no credible evidence to back that up. But like a lot of his information, Bardo heard that on Fox News.
And there are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd. We'll have more.
This is where we are. Our country is awash in disinformation. People get to choose their own reality. And in Bardo's reality, with the Democrats taking control, more violence is coming.
If it gets to that point where they come to try and take our weapons, if they want to stifle us any further than they already are with the free speech, it's going to happen.
Hundreds of miles north in Montana's conservative Bitterroot Valley, Marine Corps veteran Taylan Lang says he's also worried about more violence. He tells me he was out shooting his rifle at a gun range recently.
And, you know, the guy who was sitting next to me was talking about, you know, this is all very important because we have the revolution that's coming and, you know, everybody has to be prepared to, you know, fight the government and the liberals and, you know, socialism and all this kind of stuff.
Here's the thing, though. Lang is one of those liberals. And when he saw what happened at the U.S. Capitol, he says he wept for his country.
I mean, we had this whole segment of people who are they truly believe that they're patriots. And they're in that position and they're storming the halls of the Capitol because they believe falsehoods.
Those falsehoods have crept into small towns and rural communities across the West, helping fuel distrust in everything from public health measures to November's election. But Maddie Bishop says there's something else at play here, too. Bishop lives in Libby, Montana. He voted Libertarian in the last election, but says a lot of his friends are Trump supporters.
Even yesterday, as the images from the Capitol were being broadcast, they're justifying what's happening, that we've reached a breaking point. The system is broken. They feel betrayed. And to be honest, I think rural America has been betrayed, but that's happened over the course of the last 20 years.
He says many of his neighbors are angry and desperate because, in their minds, their traditional way of life has been taken away. Logging and mining contracts have dried up. Small businesses struggle to compete against big companies like Walmart and Amazon. America's wealth gap, after all, has doubled over the past three decades, and Trump tapped into some of that anger. Still, Bishop doesn't understand why some of his friends followed Trump down the rabbit hole and don't believe in facts anymore.
We're in big trouble because right now, what you call a fact, another person disputes and says, well, that's not true because I saw a YouTube video that my cousin posted and I trust him more than I trust this media guy. And it's detrimental to everything that we have no consensus of truth, no consensus of fact in this country right now.
A democracy without facts is like a truck without oil. The engine seizes. It can't run. That's what worries Julie Weitz. She lives in Sheridan, Wyoming. She was shocked by what happened at the Capitol.
I'm stunned.
But she says in Sheridan, there's also two realities.
I've noticed that when we have those conversations about Donald Trump, it turns into kind of a, I'll call it the whataboutism. It's kind of like a never-ending spiral that suddenly I find myself trying to explain or justify something that didn't really happen, that I can clearly see that person believes, but it isn't true. And so then I just feel like throwing my hands up in the air because they can't be reached.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
When we come back, federal funding may allow carbon capture efforts to accelerate as some continue trying to slow the decline of coal. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, the rise of food insecurity in shrinking towns.
We've had some very devastating hailstorms that destroyed the gardens that a lot of people depend on to eat off of through the fall and the winter.
The Garden on the Prairie, part 7 of our Ghost Towning series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. At the end of last year, Congress passed a massive bill to fund the government and provide stimulus checks to Americans. That bill also contained something surprising. It authorized the largest amount of money ever for carbon capture, utilization, and storage, a technology that Wyoming has heavily invested in and promoted for years in order to save coal. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports what this new support means for the state.
Let's talk about this exciting new approach for coal. One of these, Jupiter Oxygen, and it's a process called an oxycombustion retrofit.
This is a video explaining the work of a carbon capture company called Jupiter Oxygen, which has plans to soon set up shop in Wyoming. Steve Krimsky is with the company and says federal support has been critical over the past decade in getting near the point of construction. Not only did they work with the Department of Energy for a decade, but took advantage of a federal tax credit called 45Q.
If you do not have 45Q, then carbon capture will not happen.
Krimsky says his company expects to begin retrofitting PacifiCorp's Dave Johnston plant in eastern Wyoming with commercialized tech as soon as next year. He says the plant would otherwise shut down if carbon capture isn't deployed. It's set for retirement in 2027. Jupiter Oxygen also has bigger plans for Wyoming, and Krimsky expects to take advantage of the new federal support.
But we're looking at 7 different projects right there in the state of Wyoming. That's going to result in a total capture of about 6 million metric tons of carbon on a yearly basis, investment cost of approximately $2 billion.
Wyoming leaders expect to be active in pursuing many new projects beyond just Jupiter Oxygen with the newfound federal support, considering the state has been building up infrastructure around carbon capture for years, with a developing CO2 pipeline network, a storage project, and a carbon capture standard passed last legislative session to push the tech. The state views it as a necessary means to keep coal-fired electricity going.
Strategically, we're very well positioned to take advantage of it.
That's Dr. Glenn Morrell, who leads the Wyoming Energy Authority, which he describes as a quarterback for Wyoming's carbon capture efforts. The federal bill authorizes more than $6 billion for research, development, and demonstration of CCUS. Authorizes is the key word, given the government would still have to appropriate that money. In several sections, the bill extends a tax credit, improves a loan program, reduces risk of projects, lays out plans for more support, and makes way for several new commercial-scale demonstrations, including adding carbon capture to coal-fired power plants, something Wyoming is very interested in. U.S. Senator John Barrasso was instrumental in pushing support for the tech. Morrell's organization and the governor's office expect to take advantage of the potential funds.
We will do anything we can to encourage and incentivize the companies and corporations to invest in within Wyoming.
Brad Crabtree says this bill is a big vote of confidence for the young technology. He's with Carbon Capture Coalition, an advocacy group for the tech.
This is the first time that the federal government, in terms of research, development, and demonstration of new energy technologies, has started to put carbon capture on an equal footing with other critical energy technologies.
Global CCS Institute says carbon capture is vital to achieving climate change targets, a think tank devoted to deploying more CCS. It finds the tech would need to reduce roughly 10% of cumulative emissions by 2050 to reach those climate goals. But the tech just isn't there yet. Quote, it's not happening quickly enough, end quote, according to an annual report. A Bloomberg article asks, will COVID stimulus be the breakthrough carbon capture has been waiting for? Brad Crabtree says, it's important, but probably not groundbreaking.
It's a huge first step that puts us on that path of further progress.
Dennis Wamstead is with Renewable Think Tank, the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He's long been critical of carbon capture's ability to save coal.
If the coal industry had started this work in 2010, we would be in a different place. But for any number of reasons, it didn't get started in 2010. So now in 2020, we have a whole different set of, you know, facts on the ground.
Wamstead says his group is happy to see carbon capture support, though, like direct air capture, in order to reduce emissions. He also echoed the others in saying it's early. Congress may appropriate all the funds for carbon capture, or none of it. And word on the street is Biden supports carbon capture, too. Advocate for the tech, Brad Crabtree, says even if funds are appropriated, there's still a lot of work before carbon capture will be widely profitable. First, these funds would need to help lay the groundwork for new projects.
And with that, then we'll have the ability between 2030, 2050, or 2035 and 2050 to scale it up to the levels that we need to meet those really challenging climate goals.
The problem is, by 2050, it's hard to say where coal will be. The U.S. Energy Information Administration predicts coal will continue its precipitous fall in providing American electricity, dropping to near 10% of net generation, down from around 50% back in 2001. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Changing gears, the University of Wyoming has prioritized testing for its community during the COVID-19 pandemic. Its testing program started at the beginning of the school year, and it's been an important tool as UW monitored the presence of the virus. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has more.
It started with randomized testing. Then it evolved into weekly tests for all employees and graduate students, and twice-weekly tests for all undergraduate students. Through a partnership with Vault Health, all of these tests were free to the UW community, but they were costly to the university. So the school started developing its own test that saves time, money, and resources. State Vet Lab Director Will Ligreed is in charge of running the samples. He says they're done in batches or pools.
we have scarce resources. I mean, everybody is testing, so resources are really hard to come by. So by pooling samples, we use one quarter the number of resources. That comes also with a reduced cost. If you're using a quarter as much, the cost goes down significantly.
This allows them to test more people. They take the saliva of four people, combine it, and do a test. Lagreed says combining the samples dilutes them very little, and it doesn't cause a higher rate of false positives. The machine that combines them tracks whose saliva it is using a QR code etched in the bottom of their tubes. That's linked to a person's campus ID when they check in for testing.
It keeps track of every sample and every movement of every sample.
Another big advantage to using robotics is that someone doesn't have to do the tedious tasks like putting hundreds of samples together. He says this will be even more important when students return and the number of tests increases significantly. If a pool tests positive, then all four people in that pool have to take an individual confirmatory test to find which is carrying the virus. Dr. Donna O'Toole at the vet lab says this is a common sampling method for animals.
That's kind of a standard procedure that is used, and we do that all the time with animal diseases, like for some of the common viral diseases. Like if a herd is tested, we will do pooling. Sometimes the pooling is small, like 5 samples in a pool or 20 samples in a pool, and it's just to try and bring the cost down.
But he says it's only an efficient system if the rate of positive cases is low.
If you've got a high number of positives, there's a lot of retests being done to identify who in that pool was positive. Was it one person or two people? So instead of it just being a one-stage test, if there's a lot of positives, you're doing a lot of retesting to identify which individual rather than groups of four.
Lagreed agrees and says UW has actually been doing fairly well.
Even at the worst this fall in the university, from a testing standpoint, the number of cases was relatively low, certainly less than 10%. So from an efficiency standpoint, we're still ahead of the game by having people undergo pooled testing, surveillance-type testing.
He admits it's an inconvenience for people to be retested, but the numbers really aren't that high. One thing the pooling approach doesn't do is make it clear if you're positive or negative for the virus. If your result is part of a negative pool, the email simply thanks you for your participation. If your result is part of a positive pool, it tells you to come back for an individual retest. This has confused many UW community members, but Lagreed says this might not be such a bad thing.
So what we don't want to have people do is get a negative result and think, I'm good to go. I can, you know, go about my business as normal because I'm not infected. That's just not what a negative test tells you.
The university is currently testing between 2,000 and 3,000 people a week. That number will increase when students return to campus. UW believes this vigorous testing approach is the best way they can keep COVID-19 numbers under control. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Angle.
Coming up, we will learn that some healthcare providers are not getting the coronavirus vaccine, and some Wyoming CARES Act money may have missed some who need it. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Moyambi was excited to take his friends on a cycling trip across his home country of Uganda. But one night for dinner, they had to get creative.
I had my friend cut off the head. He kept saying he had never done it before.
A vegan's guide to eating chicken. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The COVID-19 vaccine has been touted as the light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic. But for that to be true, people have to actually take it. And so far, the vaccination distribution has been slow. And part of the problem is some don't want to take it. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains.
Right when the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine was approved, the federal government started shipping boxes to states,
and the Moderna vaccine was only a week behind. Since then, Wyoming has received over 25,000 doses, but only 35% of those have been administered as of January 7th.
You can't just open the box and hand out and say, here's your vaccine. There are a lot of unique challenges.
That's the Wyoming Department of Health's Kim Detai. She says there are lots of logistics that are slowing the progress of getting that shot in the arm. Vaccines arrived during the holidays when many healthcare providers were off or with their families. And both vaccines require different storage methods. And then, of course, there's the scheduling of appointments.
The little bottle that has a certain number of doses in it, you want to be sure you're not just opening it for one person. You've got to do some planning and scheduling so that nothing is wasted. We don't want to waste that important resource.
And all of those logistics have been left up to the state and local health departments to figure out without federal guidelines. Detai says that's the right move because counties understand their communities better. But Natrona County Public Health Officer Dr. Mark Dowell disagrees.
If we had had a national plan, we would have a very easy footprint to follow, but we don't. And this has been a nightmare.
Dowell, who is also an infectious disease specialist, says the Natrona County Health Department is overwhelmed by trying to figure out how to schedule and get the vaccine out to people.
Which is eating up tremendous employee time and energy and burning people out because we have to figure out what to do instead of having a national program.
But even with this challenge, Dowell is optimistic that the vaccine is here so society can hopefully return back to some kind of new normal. However, a new problem has arisen.
What's disturbing is some physicians in their offices are not willing to take the vaccine and telling their patients not to get it.
Roughly 50% of the priority 1A groups in Natrona County are declining the vaccine. The majority of this group are medical professionals. Dowell says this isn't helping people feel confident about taking the vaccine.
To me, that is the antithesis of why you became a healthcare provider and what you're supposed to do to educate your patients and look out for their well-being and do the best thing for them.
Things are even worse in Campbell County, where as of this week, only 27% of the priority 1A group has taken the vaccine there. Jane Glosser with the Campbell County Public Health Department says she's not sure why there has been such opposition.
We are working with medical providers to get information out regarding the vaccine, the development, making sure that they have all the most current information to make everybody as comfortable as possible to encourage them to take the vaccine.
Both Glosser and Dowell are not losing hope. As they continue down the priority groups, they believe more people will take it.
As, you know, other frontline workers and other populations are able to get the vaccine, that will be a demonstration to other people in the community that, oh, this is, you know, it works. They're not getting sick. You know, nothing happened to them. They didn't grow a third eye.
So both communities are chugging along, reaching out to people that are first in line and preparing to distribute the vaccine through the county so others can access it.
We want to go as much as possible to those facilities and agencies to help, you know, make it easier and less stressful on the employees.
The hope is that if people take the vaccine, society will soon return back to some kind of normal. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, known as CARES, was the largest stimulus bill ever passed in the United States. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports that Wyoming's cut went to various sectors of the economy, but there's criticism of how that money was split up and concerns that Wyoming will need more funding as the pandemic continues.
The stated goal of CARES Act was to support individuals, families, businesses, and industries as they weather the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. The act included those $1,200 checks most received in the spring. It supplemented state unemployment benefits and included more than $1 trillion in forgivable loans for businesses and corporations. The CARES Act also directly paid each state no less than $1.25 billion to be spent as the state saw fit. Wyoming has now divvied up and spent almost that entire amount. Michael Perlman, a spokesman for Governor Mark Gordon, says the money has been well spent, fortifying livelihoods and protecting lives.
We know that there's going to be continued challenges for the economy, but we're trying to look forward to sort of the next phases. I think that the CARES Act money that we have received has been really effectively utilized.
The largest chunk of this funding, about $500 million, or 40% of the state's total, was put into business and economic relief efforts.
The legislature set out some parameters as to how they wanted to see the money spent. And one of the big ones was to make sure that Wyoming businesses got an adequate amount through what was a difficult spring.
That $500 million was distributed by the Wyoming Business Council, with grants awarded throughout the year. Originally, business and economic relief efforts were given just $325 million. But as the pandemic wore on, additional funds were brought under the Business Council's purview and distributed to business and agriculture. Josh Durrell runs the Business Council and says he's proud of what the money has accomplished, allowing businesses to survive and even rebound.
And this money was really intended to provide business relief and help our community stay strong during the course of the year, knowing that it was going to be really, really challenging. We had over 9,000 businesses applied for relief, and that accounted for almost 40,000 employees across the state.
The Business Council also supported programs to boost broadband access and to help oil and gas companies complete projects delayed by the pandemic. The council's last round of grant giving was the Endurance Fund, which helped some small businesses and nonprofits. It gave out more than $80 million, but still had to turn down some applicants.
I think the need was greater. But and so here's a little bit of the challenge. I know that folks needed more, and we could have used some more to fund that.
But Durrell says applicants turned down for previous grants were given preference.
So at least everybody that needed something got something out of the program.
Some CARES funding also went to education and healthcare for a variety of needs, from technology to staff recruitment. The governor also devoted $136 million to testing and contact tracing, with the lion's share spent on testing. Business relief, education, and healthcare together accounted for almost 80% of the state's CARES funding. And the smallest sliver of CARES funding, less than 0.5%, went to eviction protection and food insecurity efforts. According to those who work closely with the issue, that's nowhere near enough help for Wyoming's at-risk population.
I think it's heartbreaking.
That's Josh Watanabe, the executive director of Laramie Interfaith. Although it's known mainly as a food pantry, one of Interfaith's main goals is actually homelessness prevention, helping people through hard times with vouchers or rental assistance.
Our phones ring nonstop. Now, that's not all housing, but I have difficulty having conversations with my staff because the phone does not stop ringing.
The Wyoming Emergency Housing Assistance Program was originally given $15 million in CARES funding. By December, the program had given out just a little more than 10% of that, returning the rest to the governor for reallocation. The housing program's director called it a success, saying that this 10%, this $1.5 million, accurately represented the need in Wyoming. But Watanabe says that's insulting. The need is much greater. In Laramie, Interfaith paid out $200,000 in rental and utility assistance last year. That's what they can afford with the funding they have. But Watanabe estimated the need could be as great as 2 or 3 times that, and that's just in Laramie.
There is an unknown and unmeasured need. You know, we're not the solution right now. We can't meet the need that is out there. We can't do it alone.
The CARES Rental Assistance Program rejected 1/3 of the applications it received, in part because it had stringent qualifications. Certain income and copay requirements had to be met, and someone's loss of income had to be directly related to the pandemic. At Interfaith, Watanabe said that particular qualification leaves out a lot of people who are struggling right now.
You know, if somebody couldn't get a job in February before COVID happened, there was zero chance of them getting a job in April after COVID shut everything down. So they may not have lost their job because of COVID, but they certainly weren't going to find a job with COVID happening.
The new stimulus package from Congress doesn't include a direct payment to Wyoming this time, but it does give the state more time to distribute the $18 million from CARES that's still unallocated. It's not clear if the issue of rental assistance will be revisited. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Nearly 500 Wyomingites have died from the coronavirus since April. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler brings us this obituary of Cheyenne resident Sharon Widener. Widener is survived by her two children, a granddaughter, her siblings, and extended family. Widener's daughter and son-in-law, Elizabeth and Tim Thorson, remember her life.
My mom's name was Sharon Widener.
She was a native of Colorado. She went to college at the University of Northern Colorado and became a teacher because she didn't want to be a nurse and she thought those were her only options in 1962. She taught high school history and social studies for 17 years. And then when I was about 9, I think, she decided to go back to school and she went to law school at the University of Denver. She was one of the very few women in her class, although it was a lot more women than there would have been in 1962. She spent most of her 3 years in law school as a single parent because my stepfather died her second semester of law school. We were all especially proud of her because of that. Then she was a practicing attorney. She did municipal law at the cities of Greeley and then Westminster. When we were in elementary school, one of our rituals was that we would go to the local branch library and we would get our 2 or 3 weeks worth of books. And then we always went to the same Mexican restaurant and we were allowed to bring our books in and read at dinner. And I still remember this bright orange enchilada sauce and the three of us with our books at dinner. And it was another one of those, we just do things a little differently, but it's our thing to do together. She and I and some of our other family went to almost every year of Rocky Spring training in Arizona. It was a wonderful tradition, and we haven't been able to go back without her. When she was no longer able to travel, we just couldn't face going without her.
She went to their opening game at Mile High and then to their opening game at Coors Field. She had season tickets for years and years and years. And that was actually, I think, the last sort of outdoor adventure that we took with her was going to a Rockies game.
After she retired, about 5 years after she retired, her health got to the point where she needed a little extra help. So she came to live with us in Cheyenne. And she lived with us in our house for a little over 4 years.
Sharon was like the first person I ever had to take care of. So having her live with us and for us to take care of her that way, I guess it's something most people, I suppose, don't get to learn about their mother-in-law, you know, everything.
Later, she lost most of her sight, so she did spend more time mostly watching her favorite movies. She could watch the same movies over and over, and especially when Tim was working from home. We got to the point where we could tell what scene a movie was on by 3 or 4 notes of the opening music. One of her favorite movies was Brokeback Mountain. And she loved it for the scenery, for the music, for the story. But most of all, she loved it because every time she watched it, she hoped that it would end happy.
Yeah.
Every time. And she knew it wouldn't, but she still had that optimistic, everything's going to be fine, everything's going to be better than fine mindset. And then she needed to move to life care, and she lived there for almost 5 years.
It was fairly early in the pandemic when life care stopped allowing visits. So in the last 7 months, at least, we only got to visit one time. They set up a table outside, and it was a windy day, and she was really glad to see us.
They did a great job keeping the residents safe for a long time, and then they had two staff who tested positive, and one of them was in her room briefly, and then her roommate tested positive. First, she had a fever. That was the only symptom for a couple of days. Then she started to develop some other symptoms. They tested her again, and she was positive. She stayed pretty stable for about a week, I think. I was feeling a little bit like, oh, we've dodged a bullet. She got it, but she's not developing symptoms. And then we didn't dodge it. The next morning, the deputy coroner came to our house, and she had just slipped away. Her heart gave out. She didn't have a lot of resources. She was, you know, maybe 90 pounds, and she wasn't able to fight it. We have not had a service yet. All of her family are over 65 and high risk themselves, so we would not want them to come right now to Wyoming. We would like to do something. She had specific instructions of where she would like her ashes scattered, and we will probably do that next summer. I think she would want people to understand how their choices would impact their families and their friends. I think a lot of the people who are resisting the public health measures are almost in some ways seeing themselves as the Lone Ranger against some force, but we're not alone, and all those actions reverberate, I guess, through all the people around you. And I think she would, because she was so fiercely loyal to the people she loved, she would want people to know that this is not something you want to bring to your family.
That was Elizabeth and Tim Thorson remembering the life of Elizabeth's mother, Sharon Widener, who died of the coronavirus in October. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In 2016, the National Park System celebrated its 100th birthday when poet Carla K. Morton learned that there had never been a complete book of poetry written to celebrate all 62 national parks. She decided to do just that, along with her friend and fellow Texas poet laureate, Ellen Birkelbach. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer spoke with Birkelbach and Morton about how their new book, The National Parks, A Century of Grace, came to be.
So I decided, okay, I'm going to go to all the national parks. I'm going to write poems, take photos. And I called up my friend Alan, and we've been friends for many years. And he's a nature-inspired poet as well. And I said, hey, this is what I'm going to do. Do you want to do it with me? And 30 seconds later, he said, yes. So
it was a no-brainer for you, Alan?
Oh, yeah, it was a very easy decision. You know, and I was smart enough to realize that, golly, I had to make a lot of logistical, answer a lot of logistical questions immediately. It's like, where are we going to get the money? Where are we going to get the time? How are we going to make it happen? How are we going to fly there? It's like, okay, we're just going to make it happen. So it was an easy yes.
So what were the logistical concerns? I mean, this is, you know, these are a lot of parks on a very massive continent. And actually, some of them are not even on the continent.
That's right. I had started when I had the idea and planned it out and trying to get funding and grants, but were unable to get any. And I decided it was too important of an idea to just, you know, do it ourselves. So we did it. We did it on our own.
But there were other logistics. At first, you know, we thought we were just dealing with time and geography. And then after about half a dozen, we realized, no, what we're facing first is weather. Weather ended up being the biggest logistics.
So how long did it take you to visit all 62 parks?
Well, it took us about 3.5 years, and you know, they added a couple of more national parks in there. So the very last one to be added was White Sands National Park. That's 62 of 62. And they did that December of 2019. And we were like, oh, it's close enough that we can go ahead and get it in the books. So we just jumped in the car and we went down there, and we got through there and enjoyed the park. I think it was 2 days before the world shut down for COVID.
And you began at the beginning with the world's first national park, which happens to be predominantly here in Wyoming, Yellowstone National Park.
Absolutely. That one we knew. We wanted to begin with Yellowstone because it was the first park named.
So I want to turn now to the actual artistic form that the two of you work in, which is poetry. You know, there is no shortage of coffee table books with photographs of the national parks because we think of them certainly as visual experiences in large part. Why poetry? And what does poetry have to say about these landscapes that maybe another art form doesn't?
Poetry, we feel, allows people to put into words or allows people to read in words something that they would not be able to necessarily express themselves. And we experienced this ourselves in a few of the parks. We would get to a particular park and we would be totally overwhelmed. All we could do was just stand there and look at the scenery. And we're thinking, if we're doing this, there's got to be scores, if not hundreds of people with the same type of reaction. All they can do is just sit there and look at it, but they have no way to express their wonder and their awe and their sheer thankfulness and that type of scenery.
Poetry is the basic need of humanity to be able to express what it is that we feel. So when you're standing there in these national parks, seeing the beauty that's in front of you, you take from that beauty what it is that you need as a human being, whether it's comfort or glory or finding your way in the world. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted people to say, wow, look at the two different views from the same spot from two different people. What will I experience when I'm standing there?
So two poets, one subject. What's the relationship then between not just you and Alan, but between your work, between your words?
We generally would write poems separately and complete them, and then we'll show them to each other. And sometimes we're on the same track, but more often than not, we're not. And it was kind of fun that way, though, because we would constantly be on feeding off each other's energy, saying, "But did you see this? Yes, but did you see that? And wasn't this amazing?"
Were you writing at the parks?
Sometimes.
We did it all. Sometimes we wrote at the parks. You know, sometimes it takes a while. What I tried to do is finish a poem before the next park we visited.
Before the whole adventure started, I went to Walmart and I bought like 150 composition books. And before each park, we would pick out a color and say, "I'm going to get yellow, you get pink this time," this type of thing. And so we had one composition book each per park. And as we went through the day, we would take notes.
I'm guessing you probably have some poems that you have a special fondness for. Does that affect which parks you have special fondness for?
Oh, that's a great question.
Man, that's a good one.
I think that each place triggered something so incredible and so unique. That is what surprised me most, is that when I first began this, I thought, oh, how many ways can I say beautiful, right? Because it was, for 62 times, we were in places that brought us to our knees. How will I be able to express the individual glory of each one? And yet it was easy to do. There was something there that spoke to me from each park. And nature is the great teacher. There are so many things you don't realize that you don't know until you get out there and you sit and you let nature teach you. It is an incredible feeling of not just being changed by what we have seen, but also, for example, with me, it was my confidence. I suddenly felt courageous. I felt like there was nothing I couldn't do. If I could get to all of these parks, there's nothing I can't do.
Wisdom, I believe, comes from experience, from stretching our boundaries, from finding out what our limits are. And it was an unexpected, wonderful byproduct from visiting all 62 parks that we found out that we can do things we didn't think were even possible. And how do we try to transmit that idea to other people saying, if we can do it, you can do it?
It's the great legacy of storytelling. We have experienced this. Look what we experienced. Let us bring it back to the hearth and tell you our tales, and then make you want to go out and create your own stories as well.
Yeah.
That's Alan Birkelbach and Carla Morton, authors of the new book, National Parks, A Century of Grace. A portion of the book's proceeds go to national parks, and you can hear the poets read some of their poems on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces, an archived edition of the entire show, and individual segments can be found at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. A podcast version is also available via all the usual outlets. Anna Rader is our web editor. For our new stories and more, become a follower of our Facebook page. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.